from the critter-controlled studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another Wild and Woolly Hour, a chemical-free horticultural hijinks you bet your garden. It's what we all dread seeing, a big old groundhog lounging by the garden, trying to figure out what to devour next. I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, we'll help you control critters like groundhogs and the even worse raccoons. Plus, another one of those heaping helpings of your telecommunicated questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and arbitrarily arboreal assignations. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens. It's all coming up like you protecting your produce with an unlikely ally.
WDIY has been broadcasting in the Lehigh Valley and beyond for 30 years, providing news.
These planes were hijacked.
The Bethlehem Steel Corporation will end its steelmaking production in Bethlehem.
We hope that you enjoyed hearing from the Dalai Lama.
Local public affairs.
As I say, it's a race of interest.
What we're experiencing today will later on be studied.
And music.
My name is Janice Ian.
Our guest, Lake Street Dive.
In a few minutes, we're going to be talking to Petey Yarrow from Peter, Paul, and Mary.
WDIY, since 1995.
From the energy-efficient studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another methane-fueled hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks, you bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's edition of In the News, we present a recent article from my hometown, Philadelphia Inquirer, by Frank Comer, revealing how local trash haulers are capturing the methane from their landfills and using it to power their trash trucks. Under the headline, landfill produces enough gas to power 63,000 homes. The Fairless Hills Landfill Complex in Bucks County, PA, spans 6,000 acres. That's 9 square miles, which is bigger than some nearby towns. Texas-based Waste Management recently began tapping two of the sprawling landfills to harness what lies underneath. Gas from decomposing waste that can generate electricity, heat homes, and even fuel the company's fleet. This extracted gas is transformed into natural gas at Waste Management's new $131 million facility, producing enough energy to power 63,000 homes annually. You end up with pure pipeline-quality methane that offsets fossil fuels that would otherwise be released into the atmosphere, says Senior Vice President and Chief Sustainability Officer Tara Hemmer. Tapping landfills for their waste gas is not new. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has long urged waste companies to use the gas, saying that landfills are the third largest source of methane emissions. Capturing those emissions, the EPA says, taps a significant energy resource that would otherwise go unused. Waste Management, the nation's largest waste disposal company, has been tapping their landfill gases for years, partly to power its fleet of waste-hauling vehicles. The plant operates on a large scale as part of a company plan that began in 2022. That plan calls for Waste Management to build 20 new natural gas pipelines by 2026 at a cost of $1.6 billion. 8 plants are already operational. On a recent tour of this newest facility, Director of Operations Brian Snyder explains that gas from the landfill gets routed through a series of filters and compressors that separate out carbon dioxide, methane, nitrogen, and oxygen. Carbon monoxide and methane, of course, are both greenhouse gases. The gas from the landfills is then sent into the plant, where they create methane that's as pure as possible. Natural gas is composed primarily of pure methane. On the plant tour, Snyder stopped to note that the renewable natural gas flowing into the pipeline was being sent under more than 700 pounds per square inch of pressure. Though most of that gas is going to be sold, some will be used by the company. Waste Management has 18,000 trucks, and 13,000 of them already run on compressed natural gas, including some that haul waste from nearby Philadelphia. Snyder says the company is converting 500 to 1,000 trucks a year to run on compressed natural gas. The collection trucks pick up the trash and bring it to the landfill, Snyder continues, where the material breaks down, then gets captured and processed to fill those trucks with compressed natural gas. We're the largest natural gas fleet in North America, he adds. By the end of this year, we'll be able to produce enough gas to fuel our entire fleet of 13,000 trucks.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up little in the show, maybe coming up a little later in the show. That would make sense, wouldn't it? Don't try this at home, kids. Really. Coming up a little later in the show, we'll help you deal with groundhogs, raccoons, and other mammals that can ruin your outdoor landscape. But first, more of your fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100. Justin, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for taking my question.
Oh, well, thank you for intentionally, hopefully, about to being making it. Where are you, Justin?
Lower Saucon Township.
Okay, in Pennsylvania.
In the Lehigh Valley.
Okay. All right, what can we do you for?
All right, so we'd really like growing squash. Specifically, we like the winter squash that we can store in the basement and use it up over the winter.
Mm-hmm.
But last year we had trouble with what I think was a bacterial wilt, possibly from striped cucumber beetles. The plants began to get a little yellow, and then all of a sudden they were just all gone. We also have a lot of squash bugs,
mm-hmm.
and my kids and myself, we really enjoyed going, finding the little eggs and squishing them.
Right.
However, after the fact, I thought about it, and maybe that we were an unintentional vector of the bacterial wilt. So if we have any advice as to prevent that this year, that'd be awesome.
Growing in raised beds or flat earth?
Raised beds.
Okay. Are you growing bush varieties, or are you trellising the vines?
We're not trellising them. I kind of put them in hills.
Why?
Per the seed. I don't know. That's just what the seed packet said.
Yep. And why did the seed packet say that? I want to go back. I'll probably have to go back 100 years. And somebody writing these things, I'll go, why'd you say to plant them in hills? That doesn't make any sense. You want the roots to be covered by soil and not have the soil withered away. Well, I was just thinking it would look so nice if there were all these hills. It is, though, well, no, there are 100,000 worst ideas in gardening. But this is one, this is a zombie idea that refuses to die and causes no end of distress. You want your plant roots to be buried in soil. Growing them in hills or mounds, there's no advantage. It unbalances the plant, limits the amount of root growth, makes it harder to access water and nutrients. So stop doing that.
Okay.
Because the best defense, did you say you have the beetles too or just squash bugs?
In the beginning of the year, I noticed the cucumber beetles.
Right.
But I didn't really pay any attention to them. I was more focused on the squash bugs because okay. I knew that was a problem in previous years.
Okay. Squash bugs do cause a wilting, but oddly enough, it's not a disease. Cucumber beetles do convey a disease, but squash bugs, the wilting, which is very characteristic of an overwhelming number of the squash bugs, is just the physical damage they're doing, sucking the plants out. Does it get black where they've been feeding?
Yeah, I don't know if I noticed any black. I was confused whether it was the squash bugs, and I knew about the squash borer, but I'm pretty sure it was the squash bugs.
Well, the squash borer is pretty obvious.
Okay.
You know, when there's damage down at the base of the plant and you see there's big holes in the vine where it enters the soil, that's the squash bug. I'm sorry, the vine borer. Now, how do you feed your plants?
It's just a, you know, an Espoma or some sort of a natural fertilizer or compost.
Okay. Where you get your compost?
Usually it's the leaf compost that I have mixed with chicken manure from our chickens.
Huh. Okay. So you collect shredded fall leaves and you pile it up with the bedding from your chicken coop?
Well, I try to just get the, you know, the chicken poop, but you get some bedding as well.
Manure actually means poop and bedding.
Gotcha.
There's no reason to avoid the bedding because the poop, even though it isn't green, is considered wet green material, nitrogen rich, and the dried and shredded fall leaves are carbon rich. So together they make compost. If you are just composting chicken poop, you end up with composted chicken poop.
Gotcha.
Which is the highest nitrogen natural fertilizer you can find. That and bat and seabird guano. It's 10% nitrogen, which overfeeds plants. Now, interestingly, this is a lot like chemical plant feeding syndrome, where you feed the plants these ridiculous steroid level amounts of nutrients, and that new lush growth makes the plant grow faster than it should. So it makes the plant weaker, but it attracts the heck out of pest insects. They're lured in by all this lush natural growth. And you say you're feeding Espoma or some other granulated product? Yeah, you're overfeeding. And that is, I realize it's not a direct answer, but it can really attract pest insects. Now, what do you do when you've got all these squash bugs crawling all over?
Just try to squish them.
Okay. That's, and you've found that to be remarkably unhelpful, right?
Yeah.
Do you rotate your plantings?
As best I can, yeah.
Okay. Because with squash, both the squash bugs and the striped cucumber beetle overwinter in any garden debris that you leave in that bed. Plus, when they deposit the eggs and the eggs hatch, the nymphs burrow underground. So if you use the same bed for squash, you've already got squash bugs and cute beetles.
Okay.
So you want to really do a good job of cleaning up. You know, I don't like disturbing the soil in general, but in this case, if you were to heavily rake the soil, not with a lawn rake, but with a quote garden rake with like metal stakes going down and really rough up the soil, you would expose any eggs and nymphs, and then you don't have to do anything. The birds will come and eat them. If you don't have weed problems, about 2 weeks before you're ready to plant, you can go out and do the same thing, because the birds are starving by then, and they'll be happy to go in and eat your pests for you. Do you mulch the beds over winter?
Yeah, with leaves.
Okay. Very important to remove those leaves at least 2 weeks before planting time, so you allow the soil to warm up. That alone will expose the overwintering pests to birds, but the birds won't be able to get at them if they're under a protective cover of leaves. Now, the leaves are harmless, so you can save those leaves and remulch those beds or use them to mulch another bed. But really, do everything you can not to start this season out. And then one old trick that works for both types of pests is lay boards, just regular old wooden boards around the bed, around the plants. And once the season starts, lift up the boards at sunset. Any bugs that have been eating your plants will crawl underneath the boards. And then it's simple to take a heavy steel ruler and just scrape them into a bucket of soapy water. And I really urge you to trellis your plants.
Okay.
Plants laying on the ground are always going to do worse than plants that are trellis, simply because they're exposed, you know, to more things on the ground, more pests. There's no airflow. If we go through a really rainy period, they can rot. And the fruit will be straighter or more ideally sized, so to speak, and taste better. And you'll save space. Trellising growing upwards has been a non-trend. In other words, something that actually works for years and years.
Okay.
All right, man?
Yeah, thank you so much. That was really, really helpful.
All right. I think your biggest enemy was the composted chicken manure.
Okay.
You can use that, but thin it out with lots of other compost. Keep it to like 10 or 20% of whatever you spread. And no
Sounds
more
good.
Overfeeding.
Good. All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Good luck to you.
All right. Thanks.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind all of our pruning happy listeners that permission is finally granted. That's right. The best time to prune spring bloomers is in the weeks right after the flowers fade. Same with plants that bloom later in the season and ones that have just gotten too big. But don't go trying to remember where you left your pruners just yet, because we'll be right back to get rid of groundhogs and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
For the past three decades, WDIY has sustained itself through direct contributions from listeners. Our model is simple. The people who listen to the service are the ones who support the service. As WDIY celebrates its landmark 30th anniversary, we invite you to join us as a WDIY member by making a membership gift today. This is something you could do right now to make a meaningful difference in your community. Call 610-694-8100 extension 4 or online at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up a little later in the show, we'll help you deal with groundhogs, raccoons, and other mammals that can ruin your outdoor landscape. But first, more of your fabulous phone calls. Number to call, 610-694-8100. Listen to the prompts, and you too will be connected to You Bet Your Garden, like Vicki. Vicki, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, thank you, Vicki. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's a beautiful day in eastern North Carolina.
Oh, I guess it's always a beautiful day there, right?
It's beautiful today.
All right, so we're in the Carolinas. What can we do you for?
Well, I have these early pearl. They're a type of daffodil. I've had them for like 7 or 8 years, and they're usually the first flower that blooms in the springtime, and they did not bloom at all this spring.
Do you have other spring bulbs growing in your garden?
I have some daffodils, and they didn't bloom either.
Okay, so none of your spring bulbs bloomed.
Well, I had about 3 or 4 King Alfred that bloomed, but the ones I'm talking about, the early pearls, are in the backyard. And in the front yard, none of the daffodils bloomed.
Okay, and they've all been in the ground for years?
They've been in the ground probably 7 or 8 years.
Okay. And in previous years, have they bloomed okay?
Yes, great.
Huh. I thought this was going to be an easy question, but it sounds like you didn't remove the green leaves too early.
No, I never do that.
Never do that. And what else spring blooming do you have in your garden? You know,
I've got some Japanese irises that bloom, you know, a little bit later.
Right.
Some dianthus, some irises.
Okay. And everything else did okay?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, that's a good sign. Now, when they emerged from the soil, the leaves came up naturally and everything?
Yes.
Okay. And then what happened? Did no stalk appear?
No stalk ever appeared.
Did you have a severe weather event right around the time of their emergence?
In January, they usually, you know, everything's been earlier than usual because of climate change.
Right.
And in January this year, we had 2 weeks of really cold weather, like in the 20s.
Right.
And I would say that they would probably emerge a couple of weeks after that, and they did not.
Now, there was so much weather over the past fall and winter. I never saw the national news lead with a weather story every night. Did you have any of these horrendous floods or anything like that?
No. Not this fall, no.
Okay. What about winter and spring?
No.
Now,
no, we're actually in kind of dry. We had 2 days this week it rained, and it was a very welcomed rain.
Okay. That's exactly what I was going to get to next. I lost some plants this year because I wasn't paying attention to what I call the invisible drought. I mean, everybody notices when it's raining and snowing, but you get 3-4 weeks of abnormally warm and dry weather, and we're too busy enjoying it to think about watering our garden. But I fear that a lot of plants have been lost, or In your case, daffodils are so hardy, they got set back for a year because you never have to water daffodils, right? You never have to water. You never have to water trees and stuff. And yet I have seen circumstance after circumstance, both in my own garden and from listeners, that show clearly signs of long-lived plants that died or suffered greatly from the drought, because it caught me. I never thought to water some things in my garden. And by the time I started to pay attention, the weather report on TV was that my area was like 8 to 10 inches down. There was no moisture in the air. The humidity was like 10. So
yeah.
I think even though it's counterintuitive and that we never had to do it before, I would urge people to be aware of these false springs that just go on forever without rain, and go out and water your lawn, water your trees and shrubs. You know, even the nights didn't get cool, so there was no real respite, and there was no moisture in the air for them to collect it naturally. So the good news is it seems like you've been doing all the right things, and you got hit, as you yourself suggested, by climate change this year. Now, the daffodils and other bulbs that didn't bloom, do they have healthy, green, glossy leaves?
Yeah, they did. They're dying out now a little bit.
You mean the leaves are already turning brown?
Yeah, they're already turning brown, yes.
Boy, you have a very different season than me. Not really. It won't be that long. But obviously, leave them alone. But here's something you can do, is give them a gentle feeding. This is the time, and if we could go back in time, I'd tell you to feed them when the green leaves were at their greenest, because this is the time they're building the bulb inside for the following year. So rule number one is don't remove those green leaves, because they're collecting solar energy for that flower. But this is when you absolutely feed spring bulbs, not when you plant them, because you think about when you plant them, there's already a flower inside and the bulb is dormant, so you're wasting that food. But now the plant is still actively growing. To make sure you get the nicest flower inside, give them a gentle organic feeding, and all of us need to be aware of these late winter droughts that we never had to act on before, but we've never lived on this planet before.
Right. Okay.
So that's it. I'm sorry about your flowers this year, but the good news is you didn't do anything wrong and things should be fine next season.
Thanks for your advice.
All right. Well, good luck to you.
Thanks. You take care.
Bye-bye. Number to call, 610-694-8100, extension number 3. Sheila, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you? Glad to be here.
I'm good to be here, too. I'm glad you're where you are. Where are you?
I'm in Davenport, Iowa.
Oh, okay. I've heard of that. I've been to Iowa. I don't think I've been to Davenport. That's another pin not on my map. What can we do you for?
I just started trying to learn how to do crop rotation this year. I garden on a garden, not a raised bed. I use just a native garden bed because we have black soil here. And I have really good drainage because all my garden bed are on a slight slope. So I'm trying to do crop rotation, but in the past, I tried to do intercropping. So all my different vegetable family are kind of all mixed up together. So for the first year of crop rotation, it's kind of difficult because I'm planning tomato right next to brassica or celery or whatever. And a couple of weeks ago, I heard you were talking about crop rotation on another podcast. And you mentioned, I think you mentioned that for tomato, you only need to plant, for even for crop rotation, you really only need to plant 3 feet away from the last year's plant. Is that correct?
Yes. If you plant a tomato plant 3 feet away from where one grew the previous year, you won't have problems with verticillium wilt.
Oh, okay. So it's just for the verticillium wilt. But how about in a general rule of thumb? I mean, can I use 3 feet or just totally change bed, the entire bed? I only have three big beds. Can I keep a distance in the same bed for between my year one and year two, or what should I do?
One of the reasons I like growing inside round metal cages is, you know, mm-hmm. the tomato vines of the big varieties get very long. And if mm-hmm. you grow them inside a cage, they stay inside mm-hmm. the cage, and you really maximize your space. And then at the end of the growing season, you can pull out the plant, but leave the tomato cage in place. Fill it with shredded leaves, and it'll compost down. Lots of things you can use it for. But then you don't have to guess the following year. You know where your tomatoes were. So really, you can just pick up the cages one by one and move them somewhere else that wasn't a tomato the previous year. In terms of a home garden, that's the biggest form of crop rotation. When you get into things like underground crops, like potatoes and beets and garlic and onions, you should also not use the same bed year after year. You should move things around as much as you can. And that does become important, especially as you grow year after year. I have some good friends at a seed potato company, Organic Seed Potatoes, Wood Prairie Farm. And they're mm-hmm. amazing. I mean, they are organic potato growers, but they still take, imagine a plot of land. They still only use that land for growing potatoes once every 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
In between, they put field crops and plant other things so that there's no chance that disease can build up in the soil. Now, you mentioned you're flat earth and you have the greatest soil on the planet and it drains well. One of the big advantages to growing in raised beds is that you have defined areas where you're growing. And then almost by default, you have defined areas where you can walk and you don't have to worry about compressing the soil.
Right.
So if you're doing fine with flat earth and you want to continue doing it, I still strongly suggest you set something up like stakes and string, you know, just to map out the area where you're going to be growing. Make sure that's no wider than 4 feet so you can reach the center from either side. And then you have nice wide, 2 foot wide walking lanes in between. And that will keep your soil healthy and good draining and everything like that. One of the dirty little secrets of raised beds is a lot of what we do to avoid stepping on the roots of our plants.
Right. I see now. Okay. That is a fabulous idea. I will start mapping, you know, whatever mean I could do is put some stick or plant some perennial flower in the four corner or whatever that is.
I don't like the idea of the perennial flowers. You know, just block off the four corners, run some heavy twine through the tops of the stakes, and just respect that as a no-step area.
Okay. Okay.
All right.
I will do that. Okay. So you mentioned that, you know, the importance for crop rotation is tomato and the root crop. But how about all the other stuff like celery or other greens? Do they need to a rigid crop rotation schedule too?
I have not run into any trouble with things like peppers or lettuces. I'm shocked you can grow celery because it's typically considered to be very difficult. But God bless you. But those, you're right. Those are the main things to watch out for. I mean, it'd be great to rotate everything every year, but then our brains would explode trying to figure out where everything was.
Understood. And so I sometimes see tomato seedlings, so I should just either relocate them or just terminate them, maybe?
Tomato seedlings? You mean
volunteers?
Volunteers? Yeah. They must be from cherry tomatoes.
Right.
Yeah, just pull those up. Cherry tomatoes are pretty resistant to everything. You can't stop them from growing. So that's up to you. You have some volunteers that grew up. You're always going to have volunteers grow up where you had cherry tomatoes the year before. But if you want to do a little test, pull some of them out, leave some of them behind, and see if you start to see symptoms over the years.
Right. Okay, thank you so much, Mike. I appreciate that.
Okay, I appreciate your call. You take care and have a good season.
Okay, thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody out there about the basic rules of the pruning we are now permitting. Make sure your tools are sharp and clean. Try and remove entire branches where possible. And always remember that the connecting piece, the branch collar, stays on the tree. No flush cuts. Remove dead, diseased, and damaged branches as soon as you see them. And don't try and shape plants that weren't meant to be shaped. But don't go writing all that down just yet, because we'll be right back to protect your produce from marauding mammals and take more of your marauding phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. Another wild and wacky growing season is officially underway. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll point out all of the things you've done wrong so far and what you can do to fix them, plus your fabulous phone calls and who knows what else. That's on the next You Bet Your Garden. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden. From the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, I am your host, Mike McGrath. And coming up shortly, what do you do when you look out your window and you see a groundhog grazing or gazing? Either way, it's not going to work out well at or on your garden. Well, we're going to tell you and warn you about raccoons, which are an even worse garden pest, after another of your fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100. Every once in a while, we get a call from a listener that would make a great Q&A on the air, but they are not available during our taping time. So that's what's coming up right now. Here's the question.
Hi, my name is Monica. I'm calling with a couple of tree-related questions. I'm calling to try to help my parents who have a lilac tree they planted near their house that had a significant limb blown off during a recent severe storm. And I'm wondering if there's something that can do that they can do to help that exposed area where the limb was torn off to protect it from pests. The other question is, they have a couple of eastern redbud trees they've planted near their house. They planted them, I believe, in 2020. They have been doing fine up until now, and now one of them still seems to be fine and healthy and has bloomed and budded. But the other tree has not blossomed, has not gotten leaves like the healthy tree has. And when we look at it more closely, we can see it seems to have some kind of fungus on the sides of the tree and around the base of the tree. The color of the fungus seems to range from like a white or a gray color to a kind of orange color. I'm wondering what can be done to help this poor tree. Somebody told them they should replace the tree, but I would think if you don't get rid of the fungus, even if you remove the tree and put a new one there, it would be susceptible to the same fungus. I would be grateful for any advice that Mike can give us for protecting the tree, the lilac tree whose limb has been ripped off, and especially for helping this redbud tree that is being attacked by fungus, and it seems to be killing the tree. Thank you.
Well, I have to agree with the person who gave you advice. It sounds like that lilac tree or redbud, I've kind of lost track of which tree we're talking about, but it doesn't matter. I think maybe it's a redbud. The one with the fungus that, you know, hasn't leafed out well, didn't bloom, that tree is dead. It just takes a while for a tree to look really most sincerely dead. But it is dead. It should be gotten out of there. I would not worry too much about fungal organisms. But when you do remove the tree, make sure you have the stump pulled, not just ground down. Because if you just have it ground down, then you can't plant anything else there. But have the stump pulled. It's a pain in the butt, but you got to do it. Whatever it is could spread to the other redbud. And so you want to get it out as quick as possible to prevent that. Then, as to any remaining fungus in that area, I would say your best bet is, first of all, if there's any wood mulch involved here, rake it away from all your trees. Matter of fact, remove it. Just dump it in a corner or something and replace it with 2 inches of really high-quality compost. Wood chip mulch can give trees disease that's lurking in the mulch, but compost defeats disease organisms. It literally eats them for breakfast. Do you have to plant another tree exactly there? Because I would suggest you move a little to the side, maybe 2 feet away from that original spot, and plant a different type of tree. But if you're going to plant another redbud, don't plant it in the exact same spot. It sounds like they might also need some space in between them for ventilation to prevent this happening again. And as to the lilac, not really sure if you said it lost a lot of branches or one big branch, but I seem to remember an email that showed a huge branch torn off the side. It is vitally important that you do not try and help the tree. Tree sealers are useless and can cause further damage. The tree needs to have that area open to the air so it can grow new cambrium over that site and protect itself. You know, that's really all you can do. It's really all you should do. I doubt if insects are going to attack it. Insect attacks on lilacs are limited to bald-faced hornets stripping a lot of the bark off in the fall to make their nests. They're really not known to attract any kind of special wood-boring insect or that. So even though it goes against your grain, just leave it alone. Don't look at it. As promised, it is time for the question of the week: how to handle groundhogs, raccoons, and other wildlife. A few years back, we answered, or attempted to answer, a listener with groundhog problems. She hired professional trappers, and they had captured a few at $175 per woodchuck. They had also captured a possum and a raccoon. And I warned her that while possums are kind of beneficial because they eat mice and rats, raccoons are anything but beneficial. They are a prime vector for rabies, and their fecal material alone is tremendously dangerous to humans and pets when inhaled, as it contains numerous disease and parasitic organisms, including roundworm. I confirmed this through lots of research and by watching a terrifying episode of a PBS documentary from Sweden, the memory of which still gives me the willies. I advise you to take my word for this, because if you start looking it up, you'll be showering every 20 minutes. And so, tip number one, do not sweep out the family cabin you use once or twice a year. Use a vacuum with a HEPA filter to do the cleanup instead, and then wear a mask when you dispose of the contents, and then wash your hair and especially your clothes. You should also wear respiratory protection if any signs of raccoons are present. Their scat is very distinctive. You should look it up so you know it when you see it. In fact, you should learn to recognize the scat and footprints of all the wild animals commonly found in your area. It's educational, it's informative, it makes a great conversation starter at parties. Well, maybe not that last part. Anyway, every season we get a lot of emails from people who plan to, quote, live trap a pest mammal that's eating their garden, and then, quote, release it elsewhere. Newsflash, there is no elsewhere. Captured raccoons should always be professionally euthanized, as moving the animal to another location would only give the problem to someone else or cause the raccoon to suffer a long and painful death, as studies have shown that almost all relocated mammals, including groundhogs, are not successful in their new site. And relocation is also illegal in many states, as frequent listener and show helper Tom in Nazareth, PA, reminded us back then by writing, "Hey, good advice about why not to try relocation. But were you aware that it is also against the law in Pennsylvania to relocate groundhogs? Thought you should know." Well, it turns out that it's against the law in many other states and locales as well. Now, from the Department of Piling On, the Pennsylvania Game Commission adds that raccoons, groundhogs, and foxes are rabies vector species. Skunks, too, and they should not be relocated. Very important, if you do try to catch and release any of these animals and are scratched or bitten, you need to see a communicable disease specialist ASAP, no matter how harmless the area looks. Rabies is nasty. Let's drop back to when I first tackled this question, which was specifically about groundhogs. Several years ago, I passed on the old folk advice to pour used kitty litter down groundhog holes after separating out the feces, as groundhogs are very fastidious creatures and will not reuse a lair that stinks of cat urine. Neither would I. Yes, they'll start to dig another run nearby. Let them work at it for a few days, and then soil that one too. It has been my experience, and that of many others who have taken this advice, that the animals then move on. But they move on to a place of their choice, which means that you won't accidentally pick a totally inappropriate new location where they wouldn't have a decent chance of survival. You also won't be breaking the law, which is always a plus. After dishing out that suggestion, we heard from Jill in wild and wonderful West Virginia, who let me know that she had also loved that part of my advice, but not how I suggested getting rid of the ahem solid material in the kitty litter. She wrote, "I love your program, but on a recent show, you recommended using used kitty litter after it had been thoroughly saturated with urine to discourage groundhogs. Fabulous suggestion. But please retract the part where you said to flush the leftover solid material down the toilet." She quotes from a very respected resource. "The toxoplasmosis parasite found in cat feces is killing many of the ocean's highly endangered sea otters, along with dolphins, whales, manatees, walruses, sea lions, and seals. Furthermore, the parasite has been found in other marine life that are part of the food chain. It is ingested as part of that chain and passed along to other animals, including humans. Most folks are not aware of how lethal the practice of flushing cat feces can be to marine life. I even had to educate my own mother. She has lived on the coast in southern Florida for 25 years and had no idea of the consequences. I had assumed that there would be heightened awareness of the problem in coastal regions. Boy, was I wrong." Well, thank you, Jill. I did also suggest at that time alternately throwing the solid material in the trash. So do I at least get time off for good behavior? Well, that sure was a timely warning about how to deal with hungry, hungry herbivores, now, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read the written details over at your leisure or your leisure by following the link for the question of the week at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Make it a weekly habit and you'll have a strong garden. Yikes, my producer is threatening to put groundhog lures around my tomatoes if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100. That's 610-694-8100, extension number 3. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming to our garden shore at youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. Either way, please tell us where you and your garden is or are. And be sure you visit that Facebook page once a day, where you'll always find our phone number, our Gmail address, a link to the written version of the question of the week, and links to our priceless podcast platforms. It's all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when a friend gave him a bag of aged horse manure and a couple of beat-up old copies of the digest-size organic gardening magazine and said, "Hey, don't worry, it's easy. Our easy musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Northfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziproth. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the awesome Ninja Sean. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'll be arranging my fully potted pepper plants on top of the really neat picnic table we scrounged years ago from a neighbor's driveway when they were moving out, where they, the peppers, not the old neighbors, will enjoy the summer outdoors and at the best possible picking height until they come back inside and continue to produce pretty peppers over the winter. Or at least they won't die, hopefully. Until I see you again next week. No, wait, we don't want them to die when we see you again next week. Let me change that. Can we do that over again? My peppers will not die before next week. Probably.